The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studio in New York City. If you'd like to watch today's program, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com. Today, I'm going to have on for our guest in the second part of our program, Professor Carl Grossman. He is at SUNY College in Old Westbury, and we're going to talk about the ongoing controversies on nuclear misinformation, Fukushima, and the Indian Point nuclear reactor. And as it would be, the New York Times ran a two-page story about Indian Point and that the owners of the plant are enlisting former Mayor Giuliani as a defender and how they're gearing up for a major PR campaign. Interesting that they're doing this just the day before I open up the new film, the feature film, Knocking on the Devil's Door, which will be playing in Manhattan and in Los Angeles. And just 1 month before we start a worldwide initiative with millions of individuals and virtually every leading anti-nuclear activist, professor and expert around the world to challenge all the misinformation and lies. It's a major, major movement, equal in significance as to the movement by Rachel Carson to ban DDT. The difference is she was literally alone, and they were able to discredit her in the mainstream press, harass her. We're not about to be pushed away. We're not to be dealt with in any of the dirty tricks ways. We are too many. There are many of us, and we come prepared for this engagement. So I'll be dealing with that today on the show. Also, I did not have a chance yesterday to share my thoughts on why I believe that using cell phone devices is actually worse than what many would believe. So I'll tell you why cell phones are dangerous and the evidence behind them. And then debunking Canada healthcare myths. I believe we should have a universal health program. First, for those who are fiscally conservative, such as myself, meaning I only believe we should be spending money on something that gives us benefit. So if we can spend money where everyone has the capacity, if they choose to be covered, at least those who are poor and those who would not otherwise have health insurance, but if you want your own private health insurance, you should have a right for that. But I can show you where we can save 70% of all the money we're spending on healthcare in the United States today, which is our number one expense. That means we could save upwards of $1 trillion. Listen to what I just said. $1 trillion saved. And I'll explain how. And I'll also explain for those who said, let's not use England and Canada, their healthcare as an example, because it's bad healthcare. You got to wait forever. It's not good medicine. All that is lies. I'll give you the facts on that. Time permitting today, our issue of the day will come from Dr. Stuart Jean Bramhall from Op-Ed News entitled Teenagers, God's Answer to Psychological Oppression. Very interesting commentary, and I'll share that with you. Let's begin with health and nutrition. Women who eat lots of fiber have less breast cancer. This is mainstream medicine, so this is good information. This was University of California, San Diego. And here's what it says, that the more fiber and the more types of fiber that you consume on a daily basis, the less likely you are to have breast cancer. Now, one group that has a lot of fiber in their diet are the Chinese. And here's what they say. Chinese researchers found those who ate the most of the healthy plant components were less likely to develop breast cancer than women who ate the least. Their findings don't prove fiber itself lowers cancer risk, however, because women who consume a lot of it might be healthier overall than those who don't. I would disagree with that. We have actually shown in other studies that the more fiber you consume, the less cancer you have. But where do you get fiber? You don't get it from meat or chicken or pork or veal. You don't get it from fish. You don't get it from dairy, from cheese and milk. So if you exclude those, then the best fiber you get and the most fiber are from legumes, beans, pulses, grains, fruits and vegetables. And you're getting different types of fiber. So if you're getting a lot of these fibers, you're getting more what? Antioxidants, phytonutrients, DNA repairing chemicals that in the body, like indole-3-carbinol, that block cancer. So that's what they're missing. They're clearly not aware of the whole field of functional medicine, where you take a food because of its function in the body. But it's good news. So if you, women, reduce your risk of breast cancer, I'm suggesting having minimum of 30, minimum, and maximum of about 50 grams of fiber a day. As many of you know, right now the FDA has set the stage to ban all vitamins in the United States. All. We are fighting back. We are engaging in a major lawsuit against the FDA. If the FDA truly wanted to help Americans be healthy, we wouldn't have all the drugs that they approve, but we would have more of the vitamins that they don't. We have over 500,000 studies on just vitamins and minerals. I'm not including herbs. And their safety, efficacy, and chemistry. Here's the latest study. This, again, is from the University of Aberdeen in the UK. And it's a major study, and I'll quote it from Reuters. Adults who took vitamins and mineral supplements for almost a decade performed better on one type of memory test than those who didn't take supplements, according to this new study. Researchers say the findings suggest that getting enough nutrients could aid thinking and memory skills as people get older. And this was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Now, there are thousands and thousands of these studies. The FDA chose to accept none of them. So a 500,000 studies from peer-reviewed journals done at major institutions, Harvard, Stanford, they choose not to use any. Studies published by the National Cancer Institute, a division of the U.S. Public Health Service, they choose to disavow. The FDA is a criminal organization. They cause the death of people. It is my belief that when the public knows the truth of how dangerous they are, they'll ask, why are these people not in prison for life instead of receiving fat paychecks? More good news. Beans and rice, green vegetables associated with fewer polyps. This is from Nutrition and Cancer, the peer-reviewed journal. 2,818 participants in the Adventist Health Study. And here's what it says. Quote, Loma Linda University found a reduction in the risk of developing colorectal polyps with special high-fiber foods. And this is a separate study, one more on cancer. The other found less cancer of the breast. This one finds less cancer of the colon, specifically polyps. And while consuming legumes, quote, 3 times or more per week were associated with a 33% reduction in the risk of developing colorectal polyps, eating brown rice just once a week was associated with a 40% lower risk. Those who consumed green vegetables daily had a 24% lower risk of polyps compared to those who consume them fewer than 5 times a week. Additionally, dried fruit eaten at least 3 times a week was associated with 26% decrease in the risk of polyps compared to those associated with less consumption. Quote, legumes, dried fruits, and brown rice all have the high content of fiber known to dilute potential carcinogens. Additionally, cruciferous vegetables such as broccoli contain detoxifying compounds which should improve their protective function. Eating these foods is likely to decrease your risk of colon polyps, which would in turn decrease your risk of colorectal cancer. How about that? that's really good confirmation that what you've been doing is right. You're ahead of that curve, and that could save your life. And finally, food can act as medicine, and now Americans know it. This is from Gregory Connolly from USA Today. So you eat yogurt for your health, and most Americans will know what you mean. You're targeting that food's bone-building calcium and gut-friendly probiotics. In fact, Americans are much more aware of the health benefits of specific functional foods than they were a decade ago. When the International Food Information Council began its survey in 1998, quote, only about 3/4 of Americans could name a food and its related health benefits, unquote. Now almost 9 out of 10 Americans can name it. A lot has to do with scientific studies coming out. Yeah, that's all good. Quote, people are 1,000% more conscious of the fact that food can act as a medicine and help prevent lots of diseases, unquote. The top 5 functional foods, according to the American public, wild salmon for your heart, memory, and brain, blueberries for anti-aging, apples for lung function, nuts, antioxidants, good fats, and legumes, helping your blood sugar and your heart. Not bad. Now, of course, if you listen to this audience, you know there are many other functional foods that are good also, but that's very good. I mean, they hit it right here, so I'm very pleased with this. Do you think it might have anything to do with the fact that there have been no less than 27 separate specials we've done, including power foods and talking about which foods to eat that are good and not, that have appeared on public television stations from Atlanta to Denver to Philadelphia and all across America? Lots of people watching. They're making good changes. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Some new information on cell phones and why I believe that they pose a greater risk for creating a brain cancer than the national statistics would have us be aware of. First, the whole way they do a national statistic, an epidemiological study, is they'll take every single American, divide the total number of brain cancers with a population, and then the number of people use cell phones. But that's not accurate, because a lot of people don't have cell phones or use them very sparingly, especially senior citizens, and infants don't have them. And yet in these studies, every single person alive does. It's like sugar. All the average American consumes 200 pounds of sugar a year. That's not true. Babies don't consume any. A lot of diabetics consume none. Conscientious health people consume little or none, which means that the person actually consuming sugar is probably consuming 300 pounds a year. That's why I don't accept that it's the statistics alone that we should pay attention to, and here's why. First and foremost, there are a number of different telecommunications devices now that people use aside from cell phones. There are iPods, Blackberries, Bluetooth, Hi-Fi with laptops, G3 and G4 wireless networks. They all provide a risk because they're all based upon the same technology, where a beam goes from a satellite to a tower and from the tower to you. That's a danger. There is a safe distance that you can be from a cell phone. It's generally about 2 feet. Don't carry them on your body. The work of Dr. Franz Adelkofer, a medical researcher into environmental disorders, has shown conclusively that cell phone radiation unravels the DNA strands, and that means that we could have not just cancer, but premature aging. It literally can prematurely age your brain, so even if you don't have cancer of the brain, it is adversely affecting the telomeres, which are the caps of chromosomes that either slow down or speed up the aging. It also interferes with the mitochondria, the energy factories of the brain, which means that you're no longer as able to have energy, so you have slow brain, brain fog, brain fatigue. At least 20 independent studies consistently show that cell phone radiation is more than double the rate of what industry claims. And for a man who uses a cell phone for about 2 hours a day, their sperm count drops, and sperm is very distorted. And it's this contribution that can create infertility, and it makes men very much at risk. Now think of all the couples out there who are spending up to $50,000 or more to go to a fertility expert, and how often do they end up having twins? Well, this way, you can have a planned pregnancy, and I continue to say this. I believe that if you want a planned pregnancy, you should plan on 2 years. 2 years of fully detoxifying the body, rebalancing your body chemistry, rebalancing yourself emotionally, coming to grips with professional help, holistic professional help, of any of the anger, rage, resentment, and negative or toxic side to your nature. Otherwise, all of that becomes a part of your developing fetus. I once told someone who asked for my advice, a friend, and I said to my friend, "You don't have a life, so you're going to have a kid." This person got really bent out of shape over that, and I could understand why. But I'm the wrong person to ask anything to if you want me to sugarcoat everything. I was just being completely honest. I knew this person. This person had constant issues in relationships, constant issues. Everything starts nice and ends up bad, and that's because not willing to resolve the underlying negative influence. Now, let me explain what I mean. I came up with this theory some years ago, and this was when I was working with Dr. Carmi Harari and Martin Shepard and some Donald Mullen at the Albert Ellis Center and others who I considered really innovative thinkers in psychoanalysis in the 1970s. And I said, "Fellas, I believe that you're doing the best you can, but I believe there's a missing piece here." What was the missing piece? I said, "I don't believe that until such time that you're able to resolve the dark side, the underlying fears, weaknesses, insecurities, and uncertainties in your conditioned behavior, that you will do anything other than gradually undermine whatever it is you're attached to, a job, a relationship, your own health, friendships." They argued the issue. We argued about a lot of things in a very positive and constructive way. And later, two of those individuals said they thought later that I was right, because I said, "What if you started in working just on what are the unresolved issues? What are your weaknesses?" People don't like to focus on weaknesses. It scares them, because once you start to unravel that thread, you don't know what else is going to collapse around it. Don't open a door that you're afraid to look into. What if you start wiping off all the fog of illusion on a mirror to see who you really are, and suddenly you see a freak of nature? You see something that is an amalgamation of your parents and relationships and your own distorted values and views looking back at you. You don't want to look in a mirror and see a Frankenstein. So instead, so much of what we do is what I call the Oprah effect. And I don't like Oprah Winfrey. I don't like her audience. And I've said this before, I won't go on her show, because I believe that she is mass-consuming illusion and marketing it. She's brilliant at what she does, but I haven't seen her audience make any major transformation. I didn't see her audience out there doing anything with all the power they had and the numbers they had to reverse any of our social issues. Giving away a car, opening up a vanity school. The same money that she used to open that vanity school could have given 1 million African school children an education. But anyhow, I won't go into further. I have a lot more I could say on that, but I won't. But what we do is we tend to go towards these infomercial type people, these new Elmer Gantries, who make us feel good about ourselves, who gives us hope in ourselves, who are the new evangelists of optimism, who are going to share us the secret. Once we buy the book or buy the video or watch the program about the secret, then we will have the secret. Then we don't have to change our attitude. We don't have to focus on our limitations. We just have to put out into the energy of the universe what we want. And unfolding waves will bring it back to us. The trouble is it doesn't. And as a result, next year there's another secret. Next year there's another secret, and a whole other marketing campaign behind it, another best-selling author. Whether they plagiarize or not, it's all in the marketing. You commodify what I call spiritual consumerism. You take a spiritual issue and you bastardize it. You make it anything but spiritual. You make the spiritual commercial. In any case, what happens is that people hide their weaknesses. They hide their fears. The people they surround themselves frequently do the same. So if you go off on your merry journey and you put the illusion of who you want to be and the desires of what you ideally want to represent, you put in your mind what you should be, could be, then take a look behind you. Turn around and look. Just take a moment. Turn around and look behind you. Did you ever do any of that consistently? It's what you do daily that determines who you are, the best and worst of you. It's not in your mind. Everybody is a crusader. Everybody's an activist for good. Everybody's is a carer of the poor. Everybody is compassionate for the starving child. Now, when'd you feed one? Oh, I'm going to do that as soon as what? As soon as you get rich? There's always these excuses. And all those excuses are hardwired in. So rarely do we see people make real and true change. They're hiding. And sooner or later, mark my words, if you have not resolved your underlying fears and your underlying insecurities, your underlying anger, it will manifest, and whatever you've created, it will destroy. And then you're stuck with, what the hell did I just do? Did I just sabotage this? Gee whiz, how am I going to deal with this now? Well, your subconscious already told you how you're going to deal with it. The very same subconscious that hid all this from anyone is now going to say, it's not your fault, it's their fault. Blame them. Make yourself a victim. But I'm the one who set the fire and burned down their house. Doesn't matter. Blame them. Make them feel bad about themselves. Make them question the rightness of their own mindset or their actions. And as a result, we play the blame game. And as a result, we don't change. So we take the same energy into the next relationship, and we start all over again. We sell the best that we are of ourselves to someone else, and once they've bought in, it's more difficult for them to let go. Then we've got them in a commitment, and then we can harbor on that commitment. And hence, guilt and shame are the bookends of how we trap ourselves or others. Just something to think about, and that's how I'm particularly looking at all this. Now, back to this issue. This gives me the whole idea of people not wanting to take their time to get through their issues. So why would you have a child if you're not emotionally prepared to be an outstanding mother or father? Do you think the world needs another little you? Take an honest look at you. How dysfunctional are you? How angry at the world are you? How incompatible with happiness are you? So you're going to hide behind this. Well, now I have something I can, as I said, if you don't have a life, have a kid. That's one good way that you don't have to have a life for the next 18 years, or a couple. Therefore, you never have to concern yourself until they're all gone, and then suddenly you're faced with the idea, now what, gee whiz, what am I going to do? I got to face me. I don't know who I am. I don't know what I want. I better watch Oprah and she'll tell me, or one of her experts, where I'll go buy a magazine, 10 ways to help your life. And so it continues. So just think about that the next time you do anything. Are you prepared to be the person in complete honesty that you pretend to be? Anyhow, that's the latest on why we shouldn't be using cell phones and why we shouldn't be getting pregnant unless we're going to be the ideal parent. Otherwise, we end up with parents that have to carry their kids everywhere, parents who don't know what it is to be a parent, and then kids who resent the fact that they had parents who weren't good parents and ended up with all kinds of diagnoses on medications, dysfunction, acting out, angry, spoiled, and showing up and thinking that somehow they are the gift of life. What a mess we have made. Now to our issue of the day. Teenagers, God's answer to psychological oppression. And this is a message for the teenagers in America who have not yet organized, not yet got together, and to do what other teenagers around the world have done. Much has been made of the role of youth in sparking the so-called Arab Spring revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa. The historical significance of the mass insurrections in Tunisia and Egypt and Bahrain and Syria is yet to be determined, given their failure to bring about any genuine political reform. Even Egypt, which received the most media attention, remains under the firm control of the military, which has banned strikes and continues to shoot and arrest and torture protesters. Nevertheless, the willingness of Arab citizens to engage in public protests against some of the most oppressive regimes, all backed by the United States, is a new and significant phenomena. It highlights the distinction between political and psychological oppression. You see, psychological repression is a state of wholesale resignation. A population makes no attempt to resist. That's America today, owing to their belief they will be utterly crushed. Although the Arab populations in the Middle East and North Africa remain politically oppressed, they have made great strides, in my opinion, in overcoming their psychological oppression. Youth are nearly always the engine behind any movement to throw off psychological oppression. Psychiatrist Wilhelm Reich relates this in his work, what is called biological rigidity, and it sets in after the age of 30. The older you get after the age of 30, you get this overwhelming drive for business as usual, which Austrian-born psychologist Bruno Bettelheim credits for the failure of European Jews to resist the Nazi campaign to enslave and exterminate them. Based on clinical experience, I would pin it more on the illusion of immortality in children and adolescents, their inability to grasp the finality of death. It's an inability to fully comprehend this concept that leads to adolescents' reckless disregard for personal safety in their driving, gangbanging, and other risks taking. In fact, just watch television. Watch any cable show. What are you seeing now that most youth are drawn to? Extremes. Extremes where you risk your life for what? Extreme. That's what we're interested in. The population demographics of the Arab world have specific significance in this respect. At present, North Africa and Egypt currently have the highest proportion of young people in the world. 61% of the Egyptian population is under 25. In the U.S., 35% are under 25. And there's some lessons to be learned. Are you familiar with Soweto and the Intifada? I've always been fascinated by two other major political movements initiated by teenagers. In 1976, Soweto uprising in South Africa and the first Palestinian Intifada in 1987. Both were influenced by circumstances I consider even more important than demographics or high youth unemployment. The factor characterizing both this Soweto uprising and the first Intifada is the widespread breakdown of parental authority, which is quite common during the periods of social upheaval. This in turn leads to a precocious development of personal autonomy in teenagers. I believe both the Soweto uprising and the first Intifada have important implications for political change in the United States, given present trends in American families. Over the past, let's say, two decades, declining earning power has forced most parents, men and women, to work extremely long hours. Now, what are the consequences of that? It leaves them almost no time or energy for their children. In many families, teenagers are essentially raising themselves, which has very important implications for Generation Z activism. In 1976, Soweto uprising in South Africa is widely credited as heralding the start of mass popular resistance to apartheid. And while various scholars dispute its significance relative to other resistance activities, the courage and resolve of black teenagers played a pivotal role in inspiring a critical mass of black adults to throw off their psychological oppression and actively resist the brutal apartheid regime. The uprising has always interested me owing to the social conditions, namely a breakdown in family structure in the black townships that made it possible. Once again, go back to Wilhelm Reich. And he showed that it wasn't the first or the last to study the conservatizing influence of the traditional family, especially in authoritarian societies. The breakdown of that influence is often linked to revolutionary political change. The students involved in the initial Soweto and Alexandria uprisings were, in essence, a generation that raised themselves. Owing to the strict pass laws implemented in the 1950s, many blacks, most black residents, were forced to give up their homes and property to South African cities and move to black-only townships, or what they called the Bantustans, where there was no work. The only work open to black men and women was in remote work camps associated with the gold and diamond mines, and while Soweto women worked as domestics and nannies for white families in Johannesburg, and they were only allowed to return to see their children on their days off or weekends. In 1976, Soweto teenagers had a lot in common with homeless teens and third world street children and young children, what are called carriers, children who care for parents with physical or mental disabilities or drug and alcohol problems. Forced to look after themselves from an early age, it's typical of these teenagers to mature emotionally at a very early age. Now, the event that triggered the June 16, 1976 Soweto uprising was a decree requiring that all Bantu school teach their subjects in Afrikaans, the language of the original Dutch settlers of South Africa, rather than English. Unlike their parents, students in Soweto and the other townships were already highly politicized owing to the atrocious conditions in the Bantu schools. And while education in which schools was free, black parents were charged 51 rand a year. That's a half a month's salary. The Bantu schools were also incredibly overcrowded, with 60 or more students per class, and teachers were often, well, they had no educational qualifications. In 1968, students in the black townships formed the African Students Movement to address these atrocious conditions. In 1972, they affiliated with the South African Students Organization, which arose out of the black conscious movements at black universities. The prelude to the June 16th uprising was a classroom boycott in early June of 7th and 8th graders in Orlando West Primary School. Seven other Soweto schools immediately joined the boycott. Students at Naldai High School demanded to speak to the regional director of education. Instead, the government sent out the police special branch, who were forced to lock themselves in the principal's office while the students rioted and overturned their cars. On June the 13th, 400 students met in Orlando and to call for a mass boycott and demonstrations on June 16th. They also made a pact not to inform their parents, who they believed would try to stop them. On June 16th, 15 to 20,000 students, ages 10 to 20, in school uniform, met at Orlando West Secondary School to march to the stadium. The police formed a line in front of them. When the students refused to disperse, even after the police fired tear gas and set dogs on them, the police opened fire. They killed several students. The other students went wild, throwing rocks and bottles at the police and setting fire to all symbols of apartheid: government buildings, liquor stores, beer halls and trucks, buses and cars belonging to white businesses. The next morning, rioting spread to Alexandria Township. After 3 days, the South African government shut down the Soweto and Alexandria schools. As rioting spread to other townships and to Pretoria and Durban and Cape Town, with what were called colored or mixed race, and Indian students also joined the rebellion. The police were totally unable to quell the rioters, even with force, owing to the students' greater numbers and their total disregard for their own safety. When rioting was suppressed in one area, it flared in another. It took 16 months for the students' riots to die down in October 1977. The Soweto riots heralded in the start of mass popular resistance to apartheid, and prior to 1976, resistance was limited to sporadic acts of sabotage by the African National Congress, the ANC, and The Soweto uprisings won major concessions from the South African government, and Bantu school principals were allowed to choose the language of instruction. Pretoria opened more schools and teachers training colleges in the townships, and urban black were given permanent status as city dwellers, and the law was repealed that banned blacks from owning businesses in the townships. Despite these concessions, thousands of students who participated in the riots left school and went into exile in neighboring countries, where they obtained military training. They eventually filtered back into South Africa to work for the African National Congress, committing acts of sabotage. Now, like the 1976 Soweto uprising, the teenagers who sparked the first Palestinian Intifada in 1987 were influenced by a similar breakdown in parental authority, though for different reasons. From 1967, when Israel first seized the Gaza Strip from Egypt, until 1987 and its Intifada, Gaza, which had always been much poorer than the West Bank, was little more than a cluster of refugee camps. This meant there was no central authority other than the soldiers from the Israeli Defense Force, who maintained order. According to a recent study by Euromed Youth, the lack of central authority laid the groundwork for the breakdown of parental authority. Because civil society broke down following Gaza's separation from Egypt, it was up to young people who freely intermingled in schools, universities, and the streets to create the social and political arena in which intellectual debate would occur. In 1987, Yasser Arafat and the other Palestinian resistance leader in the PLO, who would later assume this role, were still in exile. Now, other factors contributed to the strong sense of autonomy Palestinian teenagers felt from their families, and witnessing the routine humiliation of their parents by Israeli soldiers was a major factor in undermining their authority. Although some Palestinians were allowed to cross into Israel to work, their wages were extremely low. Many families depended upon the income of children and teenagers working as street vendors, and in some cases, young people were the sole source of income for their whole family. Demographic factors also played a major role in the employment of Palestinian youth in the late 80s. Approximately 65% of Palestinians were under 25. Due to low life expectancy, older age groups were underrepresented. In 1987, this group represented 37% unemployment rate. In conclusion, the first Palestinian Intifada started spontaneously when Palestinian children and teenagers and college students rioted in response to the killing of six Palestinian students by the IDF. Initially, Palestinian youth battled Israeli soldiers armed only with rocks and bottles and slingshots. The movement quickly spread to the West Bank and was joined by underground Palestinian resistance organizations such as Fatah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad, who taught the youth how to make Molotov cocktails and sophisticated tactics such as burning tires or constructing barricades to protect themselves. The response by the IDF was massive brutality, with random killings and arbitrary detention and torture of Palestinian children and teenagers. By 1989, 13,000 Palestinian teenagers were in Israeli jails. The first Intifada didn't end until 1993, when under the Oslo Agreement, Israel agreed to establish the Palestinian Authority, and Yasser Arafat and other PLO leaders returned from exile to run it. What would happen in the United States if our youth understood its history, its culture, and the fact that it has become nothing more than an income stream, commodified asset? What if it found that it could also take its feeling of frustration, helplessness, high unemployment, disintegration of the discipline that normal families have and the interrelationship of normal families? What if it took that to the streets? What would happen, do you think? Or is it possible in America for American youth to get themselves away from the narcissism of their own life to care about anyone else's? Your thoughts. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. We're going to go to Elizabeth in studio and our guest, Professor Carl Grossman, in just a minute. I'll take a couple of your calls also. Just a quick break. We've been so busy, I haven't had a chance to give a special. I just got this in, and I only have a limited number. This is my new and improved Berry Blast. All natural, raw, 22 fruits and berries and antioxidants, acai berry and goji berry, and 15,000 ORAC. That's the most of any product I know of in the world. 15,000. This is quite simply a superstar. This is my newest creation, and I took the best of the best, high levels. I took acai, 1,500 milligrams. Cranberries, 1,500 milligrams. Goji berry, 1,500 milligrams. Red raspberries, almost 1,500 milligrams. Strawberries and blueberries and elderberries. Noni berry and black cherry. Black raspberries, a blueberry leaf. Camus, black currant, pineapple, guava, raspberry seed, grape seed, aronia, bilberry extract, and quercetin. And these are really high doses, delicious tasting, low calories. There's only 40 calories. So if you want to do something good and put 22 of the superstar fruits in your body each day, and this power of the fresh tropical fruits, the super foods, every day as I do, with 15,000 ORAC, and it's raw, delicious, powerful, nutritious, it's called Berry Blast. You're getting it on sale today, a good price. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, and all that, every nickel goes to this non-commercial radio station, all right, which, by the way, is the fastest-growing internet station in the world, and I want to thank the 135,000 separate downloads of the commentary from my Monday night program. Let's say, before we go to our guests, let's just say hello to Jamil from Bronx. Hi, Jamil, you're on.
Yes, Gary, good afternoon.
Hi.
I want to say, let's go back to the basics again, because I keep on here talk about, let's go back to the Constitution, bring it back to habeas corpus. Well, I got an idea, just several. One, why don't we start referring to this country the way it originally was, a republic, and use repetition on the republic. Second, why don't we focus on the House of Representatives and Congress, since they're the ones who write the laws. Even though we vote for the president, but he's a chief executive officer, but it's the Congress and the Senate and the House of Representatives that we need to attack.
I would agree with you, but let's do it intelligently. We've seen what happens when we align with Democrats and Republicans making promises, and yet we cannot possibly compete with the deep pockets of special interest groups and the lobbying groups who buy influence and access to that influence to write the rules. We cannot compete with ALEC, the group of corporations that have been working for over 20 years with state legislators to write the rules that help them within the states. What we can do is look carefully for progressive-minded individuals who will go to Congress and represent us without compromising, without becoming a part of that chummy club. And for that, we can certainly make an honest effort. You know any such people? And let's, if we don't have them, why not people listening? Let's get the people to represent the republic. Thank you very much. Carl Grossman is on the line right now. I gave you his background earlier, professor of journalism and communications at SUNY College in Westbury, where he's been teaching investigative reporting for over 30 years. He's one of our nation's most prolific investigative writers on nuclear power, politics and nuclear industry, and the environment. And this year he received the prestigious Pope Award for his many articles written during the past year. Nice to have you with us today.
It's a pleasure, Gary.
Today's New York Times, I'm sure you saw it. They have the nuclear industry is aware that there is some concern on part of some of the public and the governor, so two-part series, New York Times. Indian Point may enlist Giuliani as a defender. Facing growing opposition, Indian Point's owner may enlist Giuliani as a defender. Your thoughts on this, and could you give us a rundown? I read your articles, but I'd rather have you go through these articles and their importance of why we should say no to hormesis, the idea that by exposing ourselves to radiation in small doses, it's good for us. That's Ann Calder's one of the biggest promoter of that, and why we should close Indian Point.
Well, on your last point, Indian Point, it's right at the intersection of two earthquake faults. I mean, we know what the results, in fact, the ongoing results of the Fukushima disaster stand to be. We don't need another Fukushima just over 20 miles from the New York City line. Indian Point, those two nuclear plants, are a disaster waiting to happen. In terms of Giuliani being hired to represent Entergy and to somehow what the deal is with Indian Point, in fact, it's been happening with a lot of nuclear plants in the U.S. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is a lapdog for the nuclear industry, wants to keep nuclear somehow going, and these plants were only designed to run for 40 years. So the push has been to extend the operating lives of these nuclear plants to 60 years. In fact, the NRC is talking about 80 years. Meanwhile, uprating them, in other words, having them run hotter and harder. And the Indian Point plants are up for an extension of their operating licenses. In fact, they should be shut down right now, immediately. They are a clear and present danger. As to the hiring of Giuliani, when we've seen this sort of thing since this major event, Fukushima has changed the view worldwide of people about nuclear power. A solid majority of people all over the world, according to a recent poll by Reuters, against nuclear power. The question is whether there's a democratic process in any particular country to translate the people's will to shutting them down, stopping nuclear power. It's been done because of a referendum in Italy. 91% of people voted to shut them down, build no nuclear plants. Germany is saying no to nuclear. Switzerland is saying no to nuclear. Even the prime minister in Japan is saying no to nuclear. But in this country, in the United States, Congress, which is bathed in contributions, campaign contributions from the nuclear industry, the Obama administration, very close to a giant nuclear utility called Exelon, is still promoting nuclear power. So we got a big fight on our hands. And just the last point, Hormesis is the craziest of things. I mean, not only do the folks involved in the nuclear establishment, it's more than a nuclear industry, it's these government agencies pushing nuclear, like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or Department of Energy, and then you have the nuclear industry. Not only are they into denial, for example, claiming that the radiation coming from Fukushima and hitting here in the United States is not going to do any damage, not only are they into denial and minimization, but some of them have another theory called hormesis, that a little bit of radiation is good for you. It exercises the immune system. Absolutely nutty, batty, rejected by every significant national and international radiological agency, but it's all part of the big lie of the nuclear establishment.
Well, I appreciate the efforts you've been making over all these years. As you know, tomorrow we premiere for 1 week in New York and L.A., Knocking on the Devil's Door, where you're prominently sharing your views on Fukushima and the cover-up there. And hopefully you'll be able to come to one of those screenings so you can be a part of the Q&A and people can address their issues with you. If you can make it to any of the evening shows, we have two showings each evening at the IFC Theater at 3rd and 6th Avenue. Hopefully you'll be there. Every single showing is sold out.
Well, I've seen the trailer for the documentary, Gary. It is incredible. You have put together... what a powerful documentary. I don't see how anybody, after seeing the I mean, that's the truth. You know, what we're being fed by much of the mainstream media, lie after lie. I teach journalism, and the performance in the wake of the Fukushima disaster by mainstream media has been absolutely outrageous. I mean, Goebbels would be smiling from his grave to see this nuclear, pro-nuclear propaganda. But your documentary, and again, I'll also with the trailer, 10 minutes, but what a trailer. is it just cuts through the lies, the disinformation, and presents, the fact that, nuclear technology is a killer. And this is no technology to use to boil water, to turn a turbine, and make electricity. It has to be put to an end. And what we must do now is to go to these safe, clean, renewable forms of energy, which study after stations can provide all the energy we need safely. Solar and wind and geothermal and tidal and wave power and on and on. Can generate with energy efficiency, can provide all the energy we need. Nuclear power is unnecessary and so toxic, so dangerous, antithetical to life. And your incredible documentary, Gary, I must say it is just, it bowled me over to see that trailer, is going to be a very important tool in cutting through the liars for hire, the Giulianis, these scientists who go and peddle nuclear propaganda, the nuclear Pinocchios. Your important documentary is a critical antidote to the lies.
Well, thank you very much, and we look forward to having you back when we're going to try to organize all the people, yourself at the top of that list, to start in September a worldwide campaign to put referendums on all the ballots, to join with all the millions of people who are anti-nuclear around the world, to show a united voice, a united face of all the people who've worked decades trying to close in points and other places around. And so we have one voice, the truth, speaking. And we look forward to having you share your measurable influence in that. Thank you very much.
Our pleasure, Gary.
Professor Carl Grossman. More on that. Again, right now, all the showings are sold out. Let's say hello to Elizabeth in studio. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. We had an email from Martha. Martha was having dinner after listening to Monday night's show, The Progressive Hour, with her husband. They're both attorneys, and they've been listening for over 15 years. And they like to let everyone know, then you know, that they feel it's the most important program on the radio. And they appreciate the fact it's allowing them to focus on issues that are important to them. And she just wanted to share, and she wrote in her email that her favorite Gary Null story occurred when her and her daughter came to the Healing Springs Ranch in Texas many years ago now. There were three buses and 120 people coming in, and she said that as they were coming down the side of the ranch, a man on a horse came galloping up at full speed, coming quite close to the buses, and it was a full gallop. He reached down while he was on the horse, and he grabbed a small goat. And this is right in front of everybody, from his saddle. And then he galloped off with his goat. And later on, when they were sat at the hacienda, she realized that it was you that she saw on the horse. And she said that later they realized, and other people had seen, that there were two coyotes. So you'd rescued the goat from the coyotes. So she said that was a very good story, and she wanted to share that with you.
Well, that's nice. Thank you. By the way, for those of you who are going to be saying goodbye because of the land-based station you're on, you can continue watching this on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Now, I was just told just a second ago that we may have some seats being freed up on two of the days. Do you have that? Can you hand me that calendar there so we can go over those?
Yes.
If you'd like to see and join me, I'll be there Friday, and the two evening showings I know are absolutely packed. But you would have to call us now if you want to come. Okay, here's what we have. August the 7th matinee, just a couple tickets. The evening, we have some. August 8th, a few. Evening, which it means at 4 o'clock and 8 o'clock. And August 9th. So 7th, 8th, and 9th. And I'll be there on the 8th and 9th. All the other showings are 100% filled with waiting lists. So at least if you want to see Knock on the Devil's Door, you can by calling our number at 877-627-5065. That will guarantee you a ticket. What
also,
else you got?
We're looking for drivers for tomorrow.
Got a lot going on. I have to be at there. There's this woman running on the Peace Candidate who wants me to give a little talk at 7 o'clock. I have to be at the premiere to talk afterwards. So that's 6:30. So 6:30, I can talk for about 20 minutes because they don't allow us longer. Then I'll shoot up there, and then I got to shoot back for the next premiere, and then I got to go to David Boulay's tomorrow night to film because we didn't have a chance to film all the people last night. Though we did film David last night. He was phenomenal. That was a very exciting experience. So people, we need lots of drivers for our camera crew and everything else. So if you'd like to join in, help out, give a call, what's the number?
It will be, I think it's going to be 646-926-5428. 646-926-5428, and that's Jason.
Okay. Anything else there?
We have had an email from somebody asking, what is your view on, are we going into a double-dip recession?
Do I believe we are? It depends upon what your position in the existing society is. If you are a person who is one of the 70 million people who are rather affluent, then no, you will not be adversely affected. But everyone else will be. Yes, I believe we're definitely going into a double-dip recession. Stock market's down almost 300 points today. Gold is up. I predicted gold will go to 2,000. I believe it will easily go to 2,000. And silver is at 43. I believe it'll go to 50 and stay around there. And I believe also China has given more than enough indication that it intends in the very near future to go off the dollar as its reserve currency. And also it's been using, according to someone who works with the Chinese, it's been using the T-bills that they've been holding, ours, over $1 trillion of them, to buy up land, to rent land, to buy equipment, to build factories. So they're using the money we have, not holding it, to get rid of as much of that as possible, because once they go off the dollar and the dollar is no longer the reserve currency of the world, I believe that we'll see hyperinflation. The value of that dollar is going to drop. So my suggestion is, don't be buying houses now. Don't be buying stuff. Junk silver, I believe, is still good, and backup food supplies are good things that will not go bad. I believe we're going to go through a really bad stretch, starting anywhere from 6 months to a year from now. We'll start to see it accelerating over the next 2 years. Hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Noll. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen in. If you didn't listen to Monday evening's Progressive Commentary Hour, please go to Progressive Radio Network and go to our archives for the Monday evening 7 o'clock show on Progressive Radio. Every week I just do commentaries, that's all it is, on important social issues. Have a nice day, everyone.